The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we're seeing some real change in the markets right now. I mean, silver's over $38 an ounce. We've talked about gold-silver ratios. We're starting to see that thing really shoot up. But that's not the only market. Junk bonds are selling like mad right now. Oil is over 100 bucks. What is it? 107 bucks a barrel. So as that changes, does the mindset change in the way people invest?
Well, Kevin, I think that's what's particularly interesting. We have a bull market in metals. It's one where if you look at the assets themselves, you're talking about gold, silver, platinum, and palladium.
Right.
There's a whole host of other things that are moving up in price, but they have a different set of fundamentals that are driving them. And that's where I think we need to draw some distinctions, and hopefully will today, Kevin, between what's happening in the metals and in a number of other markets. The assets themselves, each of them have a backstory. Those assets are being driven by market fundamentals or variables which have brought them, you know, whether you're in a bull market or a bear market,
right.
You've got to know what that backstory is. What is fundamentally getting better or deteriorating? But there's also something that I think is of critical nature, Kevin, and it's the participants in that particular market. In this case, the bull market in metals, you've got individuals, and as the dynamics change, as the market progresses, those participants can also see their mind shift
right.
In terms of motivations and the things that stir them on to make the decisions that they do.
Well, you know, David, for years we've talked to people about a disciplined approach. And, you know, we've talked about the triangle. We've talked about the precious metals, a third being just for preservation and, you know, the stability of the triangle. But it's amazing as these markets rise.
Kevin, very early on in my investment career, I made mistakes that I look back and I can boil them down to a simple few things that I should not have done.
Well, you took notes.
I do. And in fact, as I look back at my investment journal, Kevin, I've got documentation page on page of what was I thinking. And you know, Kevin, in most instances, what I was not doing was thinking. What I was doing was justifying, or what I was doing was feeling. And there was something that had come over me as an investor, an enthusiasm which could hardly be contained. And Kevin, I look at that and I realize, ah, the mistakes of a young man. But it's the same mistakes that you could say, ah, the mistakes of a young investor. And you can be a quote-unquote young investor even if you're 80 years old and are just learning who you are and how you function in the decision-making process.
Well, and it's either greed or fear. I mean, let's just call it what it is. And, you know, conviction scares me in investing, because conviction without discipline, historic discipline, is really dangerous. And is there a word we could use for that mindset, Dave? I mean, when you start to change from discipline to this greedy conviction.
You know, I think there's an element here, Kevin, which is unique. We, of course, have the balance sheet issues. The currency of the day globally, the U.S. dollar, is impaired in many ways. We can actually make a laundry list and spend an hour just discussing the individual things which are driving the metals market.
This is the backstory you're talking about.
That's the
right.
Backstory.
Yeah.
But we also have an overlay with the metals. Something that is impacting not only the metals, but impacting junk bonds. That's also impacting the stock market. That's to some degree impacting real estate in certain sectors, in certain locales around the country. And it's one thing, Kevin. It's what John Maynard Keynes described as animal spirits. Mm. And, you know, if you went back to the Latin, the word spirit could actually be defined as fluid. It's what drives human thought, what drives human feeling, what drives human action.
Well, it's like water running downhill, too. It just cuts a path and it goes anywhere that there's a hole.
Well, and what we have today, Kevin, is a strange grip on the mindset of investors. Kevin, it's a confidence which has no real basis. It has one reference point, Kevin. And that one reference point is something that we've discussed in our weekly commentaries and in our Friday written comments and whatnot. Loose monetary policy, Kevin, is the topic of the day. Last week we talked a bit about inflation, but there's something that's happening as a result of loose monetary policy, and you can sum it up with one word. speculation.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you what, though, Dave. There's not too many people protesting this loose monetary policy right now. I mean, we're awash with liquidity. The Fed's providing trillions. But there's no hyperinflation yet. Why should I complain?
No, and in fact, Kevin, if you look at different circles on Wall Street who stand to benefit from the creation of liquidity, as you say, are not protesting.
Sure.
In fact, they're now looking for any excuse to keep the liquidity flowing, because by it, they can make their fortune regardless of the deleterious effects to the system or to the middle class. They're happy to make their millions and simply move on.
Okay, now, Dave, we've been doing this show for a few years now. And 2008, before we had the financial crisis, we felt this euphoria. I mean, these markets were really rising until all of a sudden they really fell.
Well, uniquely, you had the equity markets, which before the fall in 2008 were doing just fine, right alongside the commodities markets. And
sure.
In fact, I remember some of the programs we did in 2008. It was just mind-boggling, the fact that rice was up another 20%, that corn was doing this, that all of these commodities were moving in lockstep. And Kevin, it actually was a part of the liquidity component. Certainly supply and demand dimensions have their place in the picture.
Yes, but it was a bubble as well. I mean, you have to admit, there was a commodity bubble. I mean, what did oil get to? It was over $150 a barrel at one point.
Kevin, when I look at equities today and the enthusiasm that's wrapped up in the equities market, what I find particularly disturbing is that you're seeing massive distribution in that market, and it's not immediately obvious. So while there is euphoria, while there is animal spirits, as we've mentioned several times before, Kevin, the insider selling, these are executives selling into the strength of rising prices, that's in fact what they're doing. And if you look at on-balance volume, if you look at volume for the NYSE or individual companies, over the last 3 months, you've been seeing declining volume even as the price of these equities is rising, which is a very, very precarious place to be for the market as a whole.
Well, and that's for the professional investor. I mean, most people do not watch volumes and a lot of the types of numbers that you guys watch when you're making these investment decisions. But let's return to something for a moment. I had mentioned before we're awash with liquidity. We're seeing these trades that you've called momentum trades, you know, where there's a momentum going one direction and everyone thinks it's going to continue. But in a way, I was joking. We're awash with liquidity. There's no hyperinflation yet. Why should we be concerned? But let's go back and review, because last week we talked about inflation. And, you know, when the money's thrown into the system, it feels fine when you don't have the inflation. But the after effect, it's like a hangover.
Well, and we've got, as you said, last week we talked about the borrower, we talked about the lender, we talked about the saver, and we talked about the asset owner.
And not all lose right off the bat.
No, we saw that the borrower and the asset owner can both benefit from liquidity-induced boom and the inflation that often accompanies them. The parties that are punished in the midst of a liquidity-driven boom are the saver, looking right to preserve assets and cash equivalent investments or even fixed income investments that are near cash equivalents. And the lender, who generally fixes the rate of compensation on the money he gives to the party taking a loan.
Which are really the responsible people in the community. Those who can lend and those who have saved, really, they should be the ones reaping the benefit of a good economy.
And the saver and the lender are doing the same thing. They just have a different audience. They're trying to take a resource and do something productive.
Sure.
And so the individual saver is essentially doing the same thing, foregoing some present pleasure for a future benefit.
Okay, David, you had mentioned animal spirits. Is there something about the idea of animal spirits that's particularly present in today's market? I mean, where are you seeing that happening right now?
Well, if you look at the year-to-date gains, Kevin, say, in the S&P mid-cap stocks, you just from the beginning of the year, you've got a 9.8% return in the mid-cap stocks.
Sounds like a recovery to me.
Or the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, which is, of course, heavily weighted to oil. It's up 15.8% year-to-date. Mm. Or you could look at corn, up 17%, or gasoline, up 30%, silver up 22%. These are year-to-date numbers, Kevin. Yeah, I mean, we're in March. We just finished the first quarter. For silver, that's on top of last year's 80-plus percent return for the year.
David, on the gasoline issue, I just spent $70 filling my car up. I told my wife when I got home, $70 for a tank of gas. We've seen these numbers before, but they were always proclaimed as a temporary spike. Is that what this is now?
Well, it's reasonable to ask, are these normal market dynamics? I mean, and the reality is you don't see these kinds of returns on individual assets, Kevin, or rising expenses, as you say. But, I mean, feed barley. This is fascinating, Kevin. There's a current crisis. Exports from Russia, just like we had wheat exports, which were cut off, barley is not being exported from Russia right now. And here's the issue. You've got Bedouins who normally get their supply for their camels from Russia for feed barley.
This is literally an issue in Saudi Arabia.
This is an issue in Saudi Arabia. And a part of the issue is because they're not shipping out, the price has gone up 51% in the marketplace. And again, we're talking about something that's taken place in a condensed period of time. What's the dynamic that's driving that?
Okay, so for the guy who doesn't necessarily have to feed his camel, let's face it, we need to know, are these prices going to continue higher?
Well, over a longer period of time, I think they are, but not necessarily in the immediate, if we were to guess, although the change in demand structures in Asia could distort this. You look at what's happening in Japan, and they're going to be importing a lot more of specific foodstuffs. But as the Fed configures its choices here, Kevin, in the next weeks to months, in order to maintain their credibility, in order to prove progress towards their stated dual mandates, you know, the first of full employment and their second mandate of price stability, which, you know, these numbers, we're not talking about price stability here. So exactly which mandate are they fulfilling right now? They've got a dual and it looks like a dual failure. But regardless, they've got credibility to regain. We think there's going to be some interesting reversals, perhaps in all of these asset classes.
So people should be ready for at least a short-term shock to the markets where the Federal Reserve may come out and actually act like they're tightening.
Yeah, there's different themes in play here, Kevin. I mean, first you've got speculative investments which are responding to excess liquidity in the markets, what we were talking about in terms of animal spirits, the fluid driving human thought and feeling and action. This is really being stirred on, Kevin, by those two things that we've made mention of before, the zero interest rate policy by the Fed.
Right.
And liquidity. So low rates and ample liquidity, that means there's a lot of money out there chasing anything.
The junk bonds, rare arts, what have you.
And so you see these eye-popping returns, but it's not being driven by fundamentals, Kevin. It's being driven by excess liquidity. Secondly, we talked about there being another theme. Secondly, we have the effects of liquidity creation in asset markets all the world over.
David, I was just reading the Chinese have dominated the recent Christie's and Sotheby's auctions. They've been buying Chinese arts, you know, vases, huge, huge money paying for ceramics right now.
Yeah, well, if money is going to buy less and less, and that's more and more true of almost all currencies, Kevin, regardless of your currency alternative, then the argument goes, why not buy something of enduring value, whether it's canvas, whether it's coin, whether it's, you know, actual spirits versus the animal spirits. You know, we're seeing Chateau Lafite and Cheval Blanc go back to their record levels of popularity, and it's the Chinese that are driving it. Well, Kevin, you know, the stated rate of inflation there is about 5%.
Right.
Anyone on the ground there running a business would tell you their input costs, regardless of the business, are running roughly 20%. They're dealing with an inflation that is very aggressive, and as a business owner in China might look at their options and say, well, what are my choices?
Well, you know, we talked about John Maynard Keynes' theory last week about how he really didn't want people saving a lot of money. As far as his economic theory, it worked best when people were just spending that money. So, in a way, the Chinese are employing exactly what he was looking for.
Now, Kevin, there's sort of a window shopping that occurs in the marketplace each year. When you look at your year-to-date returns, when you look at your month-on-month or quarter-on-quarter returns, and different investors will say, oh, that was interesting. Did you see what oil did this last year? Or did you see what junk bonds did this last year? And what they do is extrapolate from the most recent time period and assume that the future, the immediate future, is going to be exactly like that.
That's like somebody annualizing a one-day gain. It's like, gosh, if I annualize this, I'd be making 150%.
Oh, well, I ought to double my bet.
All right. Then I'm going to ask you a timing question, David, because how long will this overstepping occur in some of these speculative markets? I mean, is it going to last for a long time? You said people are seeing into the future what they're having today. Do you think it's going to last?
Well, I think this is where you've got two themes going on. If you're looking at things on a very short-term basis, we're seeing an overheating in the commodities market, an overheating in the stock market, an overheating in a lot of different places. The junk bond market is a classic case in point.
Right.
You know, you're looking at spreads over treasuries, which were 16.5% just a year and a half ago, and they're now about 4%. So, I mean, your compensation for junk bonds is the lowest above treasuries that it's been, I think, on record. So what that implies is that there's been this massive volume into junk bonds as people are chasing yield, chasing return. Is it because they've thrown caution to the wind? Perhaps in part if it's not their money, but also because they're in a zero interest rate environment being forced to take greater and greater risk.
You've talked about backstory. You've got two types of backstory with the junk bonds. You've got the person who actually just needs retirement income, and they're taking risks that they absolutely can't afford to take to just get a monthly income stream. But then you also have the large-scale billions and billions of dollar kind of investor or pension fund or what have you that also is trying to beat inflation.
Kevin, when you look at sort of these dual thematics in a given asset class, let's take oil as an example.
Yeah.
You've got the big picture on oil where supplies are diminishing while demand is increasing.
And you have the Middle East turmoil.
Well, but that's the second story.
Okay.
That's the second story. The primary is that your long-term supply and demand disparities are going to see the price moving higher over a longer period of time.
Well, and that's a good point, David, because even though we are over 100 right now because of the Middle Eastern situation, we were over 90 before any of this stuff blew up with Mubarak.
Well, and let's say that there's some resolution of the geopolitics in the region. It doesn't appear that that's going to be the case anytime soon. But when that fear premium comes out, you could find yourself back at $80 or $90. Mm. That doesn't take away from the long-term picture of oil being significantly higher over a 3, 4, 5, 10-year period.
But for the person who's margined themselves or taken a loan to bet this market that they're just sure is going to pay off, that can really hurt them.
And we see the same thing in the silver market today, Kevin.
Yeah.
The long-term fundamentals for gold and silver are fantastic.
It's still a good time to buy.
It is. We see people coming to us who would not have bought silver at $10 because they wanted a more conservative portfolio, would have bought gold instead.
Right.
Said no to silver at $10. But we can't stop them from making a purchase at near 40.
Right.
Now, what changed in the mindset? What changed in the mindset, Kevin? Is there something happening that's developing here? And again, this goes back to, you know, a book that we read years ago, Jason Zweig's Your Money and Your Brain. Fantastic book. I'd recommend everyone read it because what it does is it explores you as an investor and your biggest benefits or obstacles to success in an investment thesis. And it's so many of them boil back to that lack of self-awareness in the investment process.
Well, I'll tell you, reading that book was an excellent exercise because it taught me not to trust my brain. I mean, you've often said, David, don't confuse brains for a bull market. And we're in a bull market in some of these markets right now.
Right. Well, and it's going to be normal. Again, from a long-term trend standpoint, we're moving closer and closer to that third stage, that final stage in the precious metals blow-off where we could see gold hit $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce. We could see silver hit $120, $130, $150 an ounce. Now, is that a reason to go buy it today? No,
right.
I think you need to take a very reasoned approach in light of different ratios, in light of different price dynamics, in light of different technical indicators. But Kevin, here's what we're watching happening. We're seeing this temptation occur where people once viewed precious metals as an insurance policy. Now they're wanting to cash in their insurance. And it's like going to the racetracks.
And leveraging up.
They've got the number. They know the horse that's going to win. They know on what lap it's going to pass and win by three lengths. There's a dynamic change, not so much in the gold market, but certainly in the silver market. Again, as people who said no to the purchase of silver at 10 are coming to us and demanding a purchase today at 40.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. Well, David, you mentioned the three stages. I think it's worth reviewing just briefly what those three stages are in any market, not just gold, silver, copper, oil, but also it happens in the stock market. It happens really in any market. Can you just briefly explain the difference between the three stages?
This is really important, Kevin, because the challenge right now is to balance what's happening in the currency markets and in the commodities markets in developing what our awareness is over a long period of time with decisions that need to be made in the immediate.
Right.
If someone's allocating assets today, on what basis are they doing it? And what we'd like to encourage people to do is to just do it reasonably, have some sort of a discipline in how you're approaching the markets. And if it feels good, I would encourage you to distrust it. There should be a natural anxiety when it comes to looking at your hard-earned capital, the blood, sweat, and tears, which you can put in a dollar figure term. When it's easy to spend it, something's not right. You should be calculated. You should be cold. You should be asking yourself the question, what happens if I have to go back and re-earn those dollars?
Right.
How many years will it take? How many decades will it take? Do not be trite or trivial with the amount of effort that's gone into saving that resource. Just because it feels good, just because it looks good, just because a rate of return was this last year does not necessarily mean it's going to be the same the next.
Don't mistake an emotion for a gut feeling.
Again, we've long discussed the notion of a bull market having those three distinct phases. You've got people entering into a bull in each period different kinds of people,
right.
And it kind of typifies that period.
The first period actually almost goes unnoticed.
Yeah, well, it's a maverick investor, somebody who kind of keeps it to himself. Maybe he shares it with a few friends or family members, but he thinks something's different and he does something about it.
Right.
I mean, again, buying silver at 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks,
sure.
That would probably define it.
I think about the late 90s when people were buying gold and silver. They weren't really buying into a bull market. It was just about to begin, but that was the beginning stage of the first phase.
Yeah, I remember sitting with one of the brokers that I worked with at Morgan Stanley. This goes back quite a ways, Kevin. And there was a conversation with him. Oil was about 10 bucks, and he was a technical analyst. He loved charts. He was one of the only ones in the office who liked looking at charts. And he said, you know, this is interesting. I think if we break above 12, this could get very interesting. Mm. And he began to load client accounts with a long exposure to oil. And this is, again, sub 12 on the oil price.
Not a bad price to be buying a barrel of oil since it's over 100, right?
No, but out of an office of 65 brokers, everyone thought he was insane.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. Why are you looking at oil? Now, of course, they were on the oil bandwagon by the time it got to 30 or 40. But that describes the second phase, Kevin. The second phase is where the Wall Street firm or your average Wall Street guy says, okay, I see your point. You know, there's some momentum here. I see that there's a case to be made. I'm not going to be the first in, but I don't want to be the last one in either. Don't
right.
leave me out on this. I think there's some money to be made
but
here.
But it's still pretty much professionally oriented.
It is. Phase. It is the last phase. The final phase is the Main Street participant. Each of these kind of groups helps us define the phase we're in. I don't know that we're quite to the Main Street participant, Kevin, but we're getting awful close in terms of the gold and silver market. That means that we've still got another 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 years of a bull market ahead of us, particularly because this is global in scale. But again, if you think of the oil market, Kevin, at 120, to buy oil or to buy oil stocks today at 120, your risk is 3 to 4 times greater than buying it at 35. And your reward, although oil may go to 150, or to 200, your reward is minuscule in comparison to what it would have been having purchased at an earlier price. So you've got to balance as an investor what is happening in this complex. As prices appreciate, not only does the risk side of the equation increase, but the reward diminishes. And so how is it that you're functioning inside of a bull market? You know, we've spent a lot of time here in the office talking about that, Kevin, strategizing both reduction strategies, increasing, maximizing ounces. There's so many different ways to operate inside a bull or bear market. But the very best way is to do it with your mind engaged and not necessarily your heart leading the charge saying, gosh, this is a sure way to make money. You just got to try this.
Oh, you know, David, I think it's a good time then, since you've picked silver out, because there are a lot of markets right now rising, but let's talk specifically about the discipline with silver. Talk about the last 20, 30 years, last 100, 200 years as far as ratios of silver to gold, because that's one of the classic disciplines that we've talked to our clients about.
Well, Kevin, let's look at recent history. I think that'll be most helpful. If you look at the 1986 to present period,
okay.
You have gold and silver. Again, you take the price of gold, divide by the price of silver. That gives you the ratio.
Right.
That ratio has fluctuated between 80 and 40. During this period of time, this
there
particular time slice.
There were extremes outside of those numbers, but it's pretty much between 80 and 40.
Between 80 and 40. On the high side, it actually got to 100, but on the low side, it's been capped at about 40,
right.
40 to 1. That defined the period from 86 to present. Now, in the period of, say, 1963 up until 1986, it was a different dynamic. There was something going on in the marketplace which was very unique. I mean, you look at the devaluation of the currency. Kevin, you look at what happened with the Kennedy administration in the 60s where they began to pull silver out of coinage.
Right.
And you went from a 90% silver content for a dime, quarter, 50-cent pieces to 40%. These things were changing, Kevin. And people were very aware of that kind of devaluation because obviously a currency devaluation. The demand for silver was very high during this period. So 1963 to 1986, the ratio was between 20 and 40.
Okay, so it was a lower ratio as far as the way you measure it versus gold, but that means that silver would be more valuable versus gold.
Right. Well, and so this is the confusion today. We find ourselves at close to $40 an ounce.
Right.
And we find the ratio at just under 40.
Right.
Now, the question is this a false breakout in silver, wherein we see the ratio drop back to the most recent historic range, which would be 1986 to the present.
Last 25 years.
And would be between 40 and 80.
Right.
Or are we reverting back to that earlier period where the demand for silver was enough to redefine the relationship to gold and make it a priority in every portfolio, and where the volatility, still volatile in nature, but was between 20 and 40 instead of 40 and 80.
Well, and David, you know, we've had other people on the show who've talked about 16 to 1 or even greater ratios, but those are types of things that we haven't seen in what? Many, many years.
We haven't seen him in a long time. Haven't seen him since the Hunt Brothers days, or you'd have to go back to the 1800s, 1700s to see the ratio reflected in the monetary supplies where they were actually having with a dual or bimetallic currency. You had gold and silver, and they tried to keep it in balance roughly in line with the in-ground ratio somewhere between 15 and 18.
But the moral to this story isn't necessarily picking exactly the right ratio. It's picking a ratio and sticking to it no matter what your emotions say at the time.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with some folks. This goes back about a year and a half. Not that long ago, the gold-silver ratio was 65 to 1.
Right.
So, well, they're allocating more to the metals, and the specific decision was made, let's add to silver on the basis of the ratio.
But they had gold. I mean, they just added silver this time around.
Exactly. But we discussed a year and a half ago, okay, we're adding a significant chunk to silver today. When the ratio gets to 40 to 1, you will have received some benefit from being in silver versus gold. Net of taxes, net of transaction costs, that's great. You should be moving a part of that to gold. And then at 30 to 1, you should be moving some more of that silver to gold.
Right.
And at 20 to 1, you want to be moving a little bit more of that silver to gold.
But this was pre-decided and pre-discussed.
It was. So lo and behold, a week ago, I'm in the Denver airport flying from Denver down to Dallas, and I have a conversation with a client, and it's, you know, remember we discussed 65, 40, 30. It's ultimately going to get to 20 to 1, and I'm okay with leaving money on the table.
Yeah.
I'm okay with not maximizing the entire amount that we've allocated to silver.
So what'd they tell you? You're crazy?
No, they said go for it, of course. This is the discipline of investing.
Well, good.
You have to have a discipline of investing. And I loved hearing this feedback from them. Oh, well, that's great. This is just what we planned.
It's because you told them ahead of time.
You have to have a plan when you're investing.
Right.
When you buy something, what's your exit strategy? When you buy a piece of real estate, did you buy it with the idea that this is your dream home and you'll never have to sell it? Or did you have some realization that liquidity is important? It's always important to keep liquidity in mind, Kevin. And what we try to do with investors is bring some structure and clarity to what that is. I'm not negative on silver. I'm not negative at all. I own a lot of it. We'll be happy to own it all the way to 30, all the way to 20. And if we get to 10, I'll still own some silver and be happy to own it.
Well, and this brings up another point. We've been talking about a gold to silver ratio. What you're swapping out of when you swap out of silver to gold or vice versa, you're still staying in something that's not paper. You know, one of the things that's really confusing the markets right now is what in the world would you sell anything for with all this paper that's being printed?
Well, right. And Kevin, that's where the currency markets are to some degree driving the commodity super cycle, at least as this substructure or support to the market. All things paper had for decades captured the imagination, call it the last generation of investors.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin, this was really a blind faith in paper and the priesthood of paper, which you could describe as the Fed and Wall Street to some degree.
Right.
The world of central banks, monetary authorities, and the paper pushers from Wall Street. Currencies have been extended a confidence, Kevin, which frankly is devoid of historical warrant.
Yeah.
If you look at the abuse of money systems, the abuse by monetary authorities of those money systems throughout history, you'd say, why do people have confidence in any fiat currency?
Isn't it a carryover of money at one time just being a receipt for something real, like gold?
That's right. There's some confusion, Kevin, because right now you've got a growing awareness and a growing demand for the metals. On the other hand, you've got these overlaid dynamics. Let's take the animal spirits we discussed in the marketplace.
Right.
Massive liquidity provided to the marketplace. What do you think the response will be if Mr. Dudley, Mr. Bernanke, Mr. all the Fed chiefs come to consensus here in the next few weeks that we don't need QE3, QE2 was successful, we are being smart when it comes to an awareness of inflation. They look at all the same numbers that we are, Kevin, whether it's barley, whether it's wheat, whether it's corn, whether it's silver, whether it's copper, whether it's oil, most basically. And Kevin, they need to prove their credibility that they are aware of inflation.
Well, and there are whispers of inflation around the world right now, but there's not screams of inflation. I mean, at this point, they're starting to get the hint that they may be unpopular. All right. Is there a word right now that would characterize what's going on, though, up to that point where they announced tightening?
Well, so you have speculation in the market. You have speculation in junk bonds. You have speculation in the stock market. Although the insiders are jumping ship, you have speculation even in the gold and silver market, and I would argue far more in the silver market than in the gold market.
Right.
But, Kevin, this is speculation which has been driven by liquidity. Again, we talked about the understory or the backstory being far stronger for the commodities than, for instance, the junk bond market or the stock market. So the backstory is very different, very different. But there is this overlay where all asset classes are getting a little extra boost because of the liquidity provided by the Fed. If they don't finish QE2, which is supposed to be completed by the end of June, and they finish shy by, say, $100 billion, all of your speculative community will lament the fact that their feed is gone, that their liquidity is gone. That which was fueling their gains, it's gone away.
So that could be that temporary market shock that we're talking about. You could actually see a correction in many of these markets, at least temporarily, because these people have been used to free money.
So the next few weeks to months, you see some market peaks put in. This is all speculation on my part, Kevin, in terms of guesstimation of what happens over the next 6 to 12 months.
But not changing the long-term trend.
It hasn't changed the long-term trends.
Right.
We remain in a bear market in equities. We see a push higher in equities as a result of the liquidity created. Guess what happens? They pull the plug on QE2. Equities are impaired because it's the only thing propping them up. The bond market. You look at what's holding up the treasury market and largely what has fueled the junk bond market. You could see credit spreads widen significantly between now and the middle of summer.
Now, if that credit spread widens, everybody who bought junk bonds at this lower rate is really going to get hurt.
Right, but you could also see silver owners, again, gladly stepping in and buying at 40.
Right.
Well, they may have the opportunity to lower their average cost at 30.
Right.
We're not talking about the end of the bull market in gold and silver. What they're setting up, Kevin, is the justification for QE3. Kevin, in the long history of the Federal Reserve going back to 1913, nothing has been more damaging to their credibility than what was announced last week in terms of the distribution of funds to international banks, even the Bank of Libya, if you can believe that.
It's amazing. We're losing value on our money as we print more money, but it's not coming here. It's going overseas.
Now, we bailed out the world. Our Federal Reserve, which the taxpayer is the backstop to the Federal Reserve, our Federal Reserve was bailing out the world, and they viewed that as their mandate? Their dual mandate, you could argue that it only should be one, or not at all if the Fed didn't exist, but that price stability and full employment, a growing number of Fed chiefs are saying, no, it should not be full employment because that is what compromises our political separation from the system. With having full employment, of course we have to be sensitive to what Senate and Congress is saying.
Sure. I mean,
this is where they feel pressured and would like to go back to the single mandate of price stability.
Yeah, David, this is one of those opposites that's been presented to the Federal Reserve. It's like, okay, we want full employment, but we also want you to keep the price stability on the dollar intact, so you've got those two mandates. But to get full employment, they have to continue to pump money into the system. That, of course, drops the value of the dollar. Now, David, we've talked about inflection points or cusp types of events where something is building pressure one direction and then immediately shifts to the other side. Are we either at an inflection point or can we expect significant reversals in these markets, you know, including in commodities?
Kevin, we are at an inflection point. We either see a ratcheting up in price, specifically of gold and silver, of copper, of everything physical, as we go into a tailspin in a sort of monetary collapse. We're either at that point now, or that point is still 2 to 3 years out, in which case you can expect volatility, and we may equally be at the inflection point where we take a breather. Over the next 2, 3, 4 months, I'm not saying tomorrow, but over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks even, we could see the price of silver give back 25%. We could see the price of gold give up 10%. We could see the price of copper give up 10-15%. We could see the price of oil give up 25%. Where there has been major moves, Kevin, again, there is greater risk and less reward in any of those asset classes.
Okay, so if I were to allocate money today in a single investment that would provide me first with safety and then second with reward, which one would it be?
I'd still pick gold. And I think even looking at volatility in the stock market versus volatility in the gold market, I would rather own gold today with 10% downside than the stock market with 20 to 50%.
Sure, or the currency that you're trading for.
Right, because then you've got the double whammy of not only market volatility, but currency downside as well.
Right.
When I look at the stock market today, Kevin, we've talked about Tobin's Q, we've talked about the replacement value of assets for a company, and this is where we find a 65 to 70% overvaluation in the stock market
today. Still overvalued. I mean, we're at a number right now, Dave, that we were at, what, 11 years ago on the stock market, and it's still overvalued.
It just begs the question, Kevin, what are investors thinking?
Yeah.
What are they thinking? The only thing that drives prices from 12 and change to 15 or 20,000 on the Dow is liquidity, is an inflation which turns the world upside down.
Sure.
That's not to say that asset prices can't benefit from that inflation. They can. But the question, again, is relative to what? Relative to a currency that's losing value, or relative to a measure which is consistent through time? What we discussed last week, Kevin, with gold being that measure. If I had to look at both the reward side of the equation, Kevin, or the risk side of the equation, the asset class, if I had to choose one today,
right,
it'd have to be gold.
Well, and you're not saying that it's time necessarily to sell silver for cash. You're just basically saying, look, don't go out and margin it at these levels. Long term, you made the comment earlier in the program, you see both of these metals much, much higher.
I do, Kevin, whether it's silver at $100 or $200 an ounce or gold at $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce, the balance that an investor has to strike is between the appeal of money in their pocket,
right,
that potential reward, and just keeping what they have. And, Kevin, I think this is when you look around the world, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Asia, whether it's our own balance sheets, you still have not accounted for all the risk that is in the marketplace today. To see the Dow at 12.4, to see your general equities indices, Kevin, trading at these kinds of levels, people are assuming the best and assuming that the worst is no longer an option. It simply can't occur.
Okay, so we've talked about discipline without conviction. Okay. In other words, you can be convicted that a market's going up, but just don't let it affect your pocketbook. But the disciplines that we're talking about, you've talked about ratios on gold to silver. We've talked about ratios on Dow to gold in the past. Some of these disciplines really need to be, all of these disciplines actually are developed out of historic data, not future prediction, are they?
Kevin, just as we started the conversation today, much of our reflections internally, some of them boil back to anecdotes where we have clients calling us and there's something changed, a sentiment that's changed. And this is where we think that a client needs to still focus on the primary mandate. Just like the primary mandate of a doctor, Kevin, a family doctor, do no harm.
Right.
You need to focus on your primary mandate of asset preservation first, growth on a very secondary basis. If that's not the way you're structuring your decisions at this point, then realize that you're preparing yourself for either a tax loss, radical volatility, or a long game of patience.
So if you're looking at the two P's of investing, you've got either profit or preservation. You would say preservation should still be the first discipline. That's the do no harm, and then profit after that.
That's right.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.